This is The State of Things. I'm Adam Hochberg. This week in Washington, some of America's leading political figures gathered to honor a man who helped define the modern conservative movement, former North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. President Bush described Helms as a pioneering conservative who served in the Senate long enough to see the world move in his direction. And Senator Elizabeth Dole praised her predecessor for his strong, consistent stance on issues.
In 1978, the Raleigh News and Observer dubbed Jesse Helms Senator No. And indeed, he said no to high taxes. He said no to big government. No to enemies of freedom around the world. No to those who would undermine a culture of life and the sanctity of marriage.
Jesse Helms has just published his memoirs, a book called Here's Where I Stand, released by Random House. The senator's not giving interviews on the book. In fact, because of health issues, he was not able to speak at the Washington Tribute dinner. But we have with us in the studio some people who can speak about him. Tom Fetzer is the former mayor of Raleigh, now a political consultant. He worked with Senator Helms' fundraising organization, the National Congressional Club. Also with us today is Duke University political scientist Carrie Haney, who specializes in state politics, and columnist and reporter Rob Christensen of the News and Observer of Raleigh, a publication that we have to say the senator never had much use for, but which nonetheless closely followed his career for decades. Thank you all for being here, and we also welcome your calls this hour to talk about Senator Helms' legacy. Our number is 877-962-9862, 877-962-9862. Rob, it's hard to overstate the role that Helms played in changing the political character of North Carolina. If you go back to his first run for the Senate in 1972, there hadn't been a Republican elected to a major statewide office in North Carolina in modern times. What did he have going for him that got people to pull that dusty Republican lever in the voting machines that hadn't been used for so long?
Well, first of all, he had good timing. The whole South was changing at that period of time from Democrat one-party rule to Republican. So you can always ask the question whether he helped create the wave or whether he rode the wave, but he certainly did his role in transforming North Carolina into a two-party state. He is the father of the modern Republican Party in North Carolina, no question.
Tom, you were in high school in 1972, and you volunteered on that first campaign. That's when Senator Helms ran for the Senate. What did you see in him?
Well, I had grown up watching him on Channel 5, I don't know that I had any particular even immature ideological concept at that time. He was just from Raleigh, and he was a guy I saw on television. So I can't attribute any really high-sounding initiatives or impulses on my part to be involved in the campaign. I do want to say, I want to dovetail on something Rob said. Helms' timing was unbelievably good. He got elected in 72 in the biggest Republican landslide in the history of the South, 72. Nixon got, 68% of the vote, 72% of the vote in North Carolina? Huge landslide. In 78, Luther Hodges is going to be the Democratic nominee, except for the fact that he trips up and loses to Luther Hodges in the primary, and even the Democrat Party doesn't embrace Luther Hodges, and Helms raises $7 million, and Hodges raises $250,000. In 84, Hunt should have beat him, except that everything beyond Hunt and Helms' control broke Helms' way. The Reagan landslide, a whole host of other things, second biggest landslide in the history of the world. And then in 90 and 96, he gets Harvey Gantt as an opponent. Michael Easley could have beaten him in one of those years. Charlie Sanders might have beaten him in another year. Very, very good fortune in all five elections, and the timing was impeccable for him.
Let me go back and to clarify. You said you saw him on television, and for folks who are not longtime political observers in North Carolina, we should clarify that before Senator Helms had his political career, he was on and off for, about 15 years, a political commentator, first on WRAL radio in Raleigh, and then on WRAL television, and this is a little bit before my time, too, but I understand folks used to gather around the TV set and watch the nightly editorials and see what Senator Helms had to say about the issues of the day.
Well, I think there are lots of ironies about Helms' life, one of which that he was a journalist and a broadcaster. groups that he found himself in vitriolic opposition with for most of his career. But he started off as a reporter for the News and Observer, and then later was vice president of Capital Broadcasting, and provided a 5-minute editorial at the close of the news for many, many years. And he was blunt, straight-spoken, and straightforward in those days, and occasionally had a humorist like Chubb Sewell come in and provide the lighthearted part of it. But that's what really got him started, and that's why Tom Ellis talked him into running for the Senate, because Helms had already gained millions of dollars worth of name awareness and name identification by being on television.
So, Kerry, was he one of the pioneers in recognizing the political power of television?
Absolutely. Not only that, we know he and his campaigns sort of were the pioneers in terms of using mail to run campaigns. I think his congressional campaigns led the movement to use direct mail for campaigns. But let me also comment on the fact of Jesse Helms' timing. He was extremely lucky. He came along at the right time. But also, it's more than luck. I think he took advantage of the situation. That I think Senator Helms was a brilliant politician in recognizing an opportunity and then taking advantage of it.
And Rob, once he became a senator, he was not necessarily what we think of as a prototypical senator. He didn't get a lot of bridges built in North Carolina or highways built, or he certainly didn't brag about that sort of thing. You didn't see him in a denim shirt wandering around the coast after every hurricane. What was his appeal to voters?
Well, you may not have seen him wandering around in a denim shirt, but he was constituent services was one of his claims to fame. He helped tens of thousands of North Carolinians, I would guess, over the years. He had a very good constituent services office, and that made up for a lot of sins. People who didn't agree with him ideologically and would have normally voted against him voted for him because they really thought they could get some action. They thought he had a very responsive office, and that was one of his hidden secrets to Senator Helms' success. And Kerry mentioned a couple of the others, is that it is amazing about Senator Helms is that here is this almost 19th century figure. I mean, he grew up, there were cotton wagons, horse-drawn cotton wagons coming into his little town of Monroe on Saturday. A different era. Some of his politics and racial views might have been out of a different era as well. And even, you know, he was never a computer guy. He was always pounding away on his old manual, trusty manual typewriter. And yet, here he was reinventing politics as we know it. And he had two major breakthroughs here. One was the use of TV. I mean, he understood very quickly, and the people around him understood very quickly, that the old political courthouse organizations were falling apart, and that you didn't need to go through political bosses anymore. You'd go directly to the voters through TV. So you need to do two things in the campaign, raise money and get on TV, and then raise some more money. And the second sort of thing that really set him apart was direct mail. And that's because as he came along and rose up in politics, you were beginning to see the use of computers in politics. And so therefore, you didn't have to write handwritten little notes to people asking for a contribution. You can send them out massive, not only across North Carolina, but you could send them across the country. And you could personalize it. So it's Dear Adam Hochberg, you know, the communists are taking over, please send $1,000 or $50 or whatever it is. So he was able to be among the first to understand the power of both direct mail and TV.
Let's welcome to the conversation Dale in High Point. Dale, you're on the State of Things. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you taking my call. I'd like to say that, first of all, yes, Senator Helms was indeed a good politician. I can't say I found very much lighthearted about him. One of the things, I guess it would be an objection that I had to his politics, was that I think someone mentioned something about his not building bridges or bragging about building bridges in the state of North Carolina. One bridge I would have liked to have seen the senator have made would have been bridges between different communities, in particular black and white community, which it seems to me he did everything in his power to divide the community even more so.
Let me respond to that if I can, for just a minute.
Tom Fetzer.
One of the real misunderstandings about Helms was that on a personal level, he was a very affable, very friendly, very caring man. A lot of people don't know that he and his wife adopted a 9-year-old son with cerebral palsy, an extraordinary act of personal compassion. Helms did reach out to African Americans on some occasions, most notably, Rob, if you'll remember his victory speech at the North Raleigh Hilton the night that he beat Jim Hunt was mostly about reaching out to constituencies that had not supported him, most particularly African Americans. He hired a young African-American graduate of the University of North Carolina here at Chapel Hill and a Raleigh native from Sanderson High School, Claude Allen, to be his press secretary during that campaign. So I think, you know, Helms, I think Helms did make some efforts to build some bridges. I think they came at a time when, in his career when his image was so hardly defined that it perhaps was not as successful as it could have been, but he did make an effort that make some efforts that were not recognized.
Let's explore that issue further after the break. You're listening to The State of Things. We're talking today about the political legacy of North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. Our guests are Tom Fetzer, the former mayor of Raleigh, Kerry Haney, a professor of political science at Duke University, and political columnist and reporter Rob Christensen from the News and Observer of Raleigh. And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Adam Hochberg. We're talking today about the legacy of former Senator Jesse Helms. Our guests today are the former mayor of Raleigh, Tom Fetzer, a longtime supporter of Senator Helms, Kerry Haney, a professor of political science at Duke University, and Rob Christensen, a political columnist and reporter at the News and Observer of Raleigh. Just before the break, we heard a caller raise some concerns about Senator Helms' record as it pertains to race. In Senator Helms' memoir, he devotes a good section of several chapters to discussing racial issues, defending himself against charges of racism. Kerry Haney, does that wash with the minority community in the state?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I was struck in reading the book how little attention that Senator Helms gave to the issue of race. And the attention that he did give was sort of in passing and in glancing and didn't really dive into that issue. And let me echo something that Dale mentioned in his call and his comments. Yes, Senator Helms was a brilliant, masterful politician. But unfortunately, he's also an unrepentant, unreconstructed racial conservative. And he did harm, I think, to race relations, not only in North Carolina, but in the South and in the country in general. It would have been nice to have seen those great political skills. You're talking about great communicators. He's up there with Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton as a communicator and can reach out and connect with people. But I think he took advantage of the racial divide and a racial tension for political advantage. And I think that's unfortunate, and I think that's a part of the legacy that Senator Helms will have to live with.
Rob Christensen.
Well, one of the things that people admired about Senator Helms was that he hardly ever changed. And that is also true of race relations. And he basically was an old-style conservative Dixiecrat that there were many of during the early parts of the 20th century. And his views on race were generally fixed, in my view, in Monroe of the 1920s and 1930s. And while many people may admire the fact that he was so constant and so unbending in his views, so principled, he was unable to change in ways that, for example, George Wallace changed. George Wallace apologized for some of the segregationist stands that he took. Jesse Helms never did. Strom Thurmond I don't think he ever apologized for his segregationist stands, but he did in fact take into account the black voters and began reaching out in ways that Jesse Helms never to black voters in South Carolina in ways that Jesse Helms never reached out to voters in North Carolina. And in fact, I think there's pretty good evidence that Senator Helms saw the political advantage of racial polarization in terms of winning elections. And let me give you one example of that. When he was an editorialist for WRL-TV, he did an editorial back in the 60s. Robert Gavin was a moderate Republican who was the Republican nominee for governor in 1960 and in 1964. And Robert Gavin made a speech and said, you know, Republicans like Richard Nixon and so forth actually have a pretty good record on civil rights. You could argue that, but that was his view. And he says, we the Republican Party need to, in North Carolina, need to do better in terms of recruiting black people and to vote for us. And Senator Helms went on the air and he said, Mr. Gavin is sadly mistaken. He doesn't understand that this is the very cause of the reason that the Republican Party is rising in North Carolina. Now, there's a lot of reasons why the Republican Party rose that go for all kinds of social issues and so forth and cultural issues. But certainly in the 60s, the race was a transforming political factor, and Senator Helms most certainly took advantage of that to help build the Republican Party in North Carolina.
Let me briefly respond. There is no question, and you know, Rob, another Southerner who made a very vivid personal turnaround in terms of race relations was Strom Thurmond late in his life. And I don't think that Helms ever really made an apology in the way that Thurmond and George Wallace did, because I don't think he ever felt like he had said the kind of egregious things, you know, segregation now, segregation forever, like Wallace had done. I don't think he ever felt like he owed a public apology like the two of them apparently felt they did. And there's no question that on a policy level, Helms did things to make it easier to attack him on racial things. I mean, his opposition to the Martin Luther King holiday, his opposition to the extension of the Voting Rights Act, the things using Jesse Jackson as a political card in the 84 campaign with Jim Hunt. But I think, you know, you have to give people the benefit of the doubt and make distinctions between policy decisions. He had legitimate reasons to oppose the Martin Luther King holiday and the Voting Rights Extension Act and personal things. And throughout his career, Helms had a well-deserved reputation as being unfailingly civil and courteous to everybody. He was routinely elected by the staff of the Senate as the friendliest, most courteous senator, and a lot of the staff were African American. So I think you judge a man certainly on his policy, and rightfully so, on his policy decisions, but I think you also have to judge him on his personal conduct and character, and I believe that will stand the test of time.
Well, Senator Helms was never afraid to delve into the controversial social issues of the day, and here is an example from 1990 talking about a controversial issue then and now.
Seldom a day passes that there's not another lawmaker coming up with some new idea which would further destroy parental authority in our land. Just think about it. Homosexuals, lesbians, disgusting people marching in our streets demanding all sorts of things, including the right to marry each other and the right to adopt children. How do you like them apples?
The gay rights issue was something that Senator Helms came back to again and again during his career, and we have Brad on the line from Fayetteville, and he has a comment about that issue. Brad?
Yes, I just wanted to share a story about Mr. Helms. I used to work for a clinic that worked with adolescents, and particularly with teenagers that were dealing with sexuality issues. And I attempted to visit Senator Helms' office and talk to him about his positions on some of these issues, and was met with what I expected to be some difficult language back and forth from one of his staffers. When I got back to my job that following weekend, I'd gotten a call apparently to my supervisor about those discussions that I'd had in his office, and it was pretty disturbing the fact that I had gone to his office to speak about the issues, and his staff, and I guess the senator himself, felt the need to actually track me down in that respect because of the work I was trying to do on behalf of some of the teenagers that were dealing with that. And I just had a question for your panelists as to what they felt was Jesse Helms' legacy as far as how he's affected gay North Carolinians and gay Americans.
Who wants to jump in on that,
well,
Rob?
I think that if you look at Senator Helms' career, he stood as a conservative against a lot of the social revolutions that were going on across America. I mean, he certainly opposed the civil rights movement vehemently and often stridently as a commentator. He often opposed whole feminist movement, even though he had a lot of women in positions of authority on his staff, but as a political movement, he opposed it. And he certainly opposed and was the gay rights movement as much as any member of Congress, probably. Now, what's interesting is that the one thing in his book, his memoir, that he says he made a mistake on, where he admits error, is on the issue of AIDS. Late in his career, he became very involved in the AIDS issue, particularly as it relates to Africa. He says that part of that was Bono, the rock star, who was got him involved in that. Talk about odd couples. And Franklin Graham, the evangelist and the son of the great Billy Graham. And so that is the one issue where there is a bit of a mea culpa in that book. He says he should not have opposed all the AIDS legislation, and that I was slow to coming around on that issue. But almost all the other cultural revolutions of the feminism, gay rights, black Americans, Helms was there at the gate trying to close it.
Yeah, we were reviewing this morning in preparation for the show some old file audio we have from the 1990 campaign, and Senator Helms really came out with guns blazing on this issue. He ran a TV ad against Harvey Gantt in that campaign that had a photograph of a gay nightclub in California and saying this is where Harvey Gantt's money is coming from radical homosexual groups. And there was a news conference that Senator Helms had in Durham where he talked about radical lesbians funding the Gantt campaign. How effective or how divisive do you think that was, Kerry?
It was effective and divisive. And let me point out here that here again, where these are legitimate issues, and reasonable people can disagree on some of these social issues, but the way in which Senator Helms disagreed, I mean, the language we just heard in that clip, I mean, a reasonable person could be opposed to gay and lesbian rights. But the manner in which Jesse Helms was in opposition to many of these social movements is part of the legacy that he has to live with. And it seems to be more than just a political disagreement on most of these issues. I go back to the commercial that he used in the Helms, in the Helms-Gantt race, the infamous now Hands commercial.
The Hands ad, yeah.
The affirmative action is a legitimate political issue to be debated in politics. But the manner in which it was used, when it was introduced into the campaign, is suspect. Senator Helms could have talked about affirmative action for women and broadened that issue. But again, he was taking advantage of an opportunity to use the racial divide, racial tension for political gain. And that is part of the legacy that's unfortunate with Senator Helms.
And that ad, which remains, I think, one of the more infamous of recent times in politics, it showed a white man crumpling up a job application, and the voiceover says, "You needed that job, but your employer had to give it to a minority because of a racial quota." And then they went to a photo of Harvey Gantt, who was an African-American man, and the text on the screen says, "Harvey Gantt supports racial quotas." Senator Helms in the book says he really downplays the effect of that ad. He says it only ran briefly at the end of the campaign, and he says he's seen no evidence that it changed any vote. Tom, what are your thoughts about these charges of divisiveness, both on gay rights issues and racial issues?
Well, I listened to the clip that you played and understand that it's 15 years old. And a lot of people talked that way 15 years ago. The rhetoric about the gay rights movement was pretty vitriolic on both sides, I think, with plenty of radical statements to go around. The ad that we're talking about now, the crumpled sheet of paper ad, I think, was was an extremely effective ad. I mean, politics is about creating divisions. It's about creating wedges. It's about motivating people to get out and vote. And clearly that was an ad aimed at Helms' base. And clearly, as we said before, it was a policy related ad that sparked racial divisions. I remember, I guess it was the 84 campaign, and Helms went to a black college somewhere in the Piedmont and received very badly. And there is no question that some of the policy decisions that he made and the way they were portrayed in the press severely alienated the African-American population from him, those that didn't know him personally. Those that did, I think, never fell to that level of resentment and I guess hatred in some instances. But political rhetoric is tough, and it's been tough for 200 years in this country, and it will continue to be tough. Helms just happened to be a pretty good practitioner of that art, and I think was perhaps singled out more than others for its use.
Janie, well, I want to go to a caller. Janie in Durham, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. I'd like to have your guests comment on Senator Helms' stand that he took, I don't know what year, against U.S. funding of going to the U.N., and certainly now has been shown to be fairly corrupt and incompetent, and he certainly was a lone voice back then. I'd just like to know what year that was and have your guests comment on his stand at that time.
Robbie certainly was not a fan of the U.N. throughout his career.
No, he was not, although it's interesting is that at the end of his career, and of course, you know, he was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he actually addressed the U.N. and actually worked with the Clinton administration to get some reforms through in the U.N. So in some ways, although he was, I think it's fair to say, an ardent critic of the U.N. throughout his political career, he was, in the end, willing to work with some of his political enemies, liberal Democrats and so forth, to push through some reforms to make it better. He was not an isolationist. He often opposed a lot of treaties. He was very much of a nationalist, and he got a lot of criticism for opposing things like the Genocide Treaty and so forth, treaties he thought would have hurt the U.S.'s ability and independence. But he was very much engaged in the world. He was in favor of various anti-communist insurgencies around the world. And in fact, he had virtually his own State Department. He always had bilingual or multilingual aides on his staff who kept a network of from everywhere from conservative businessmen to right-wing dictators to anti-communist insurgents all around the world. And often he knew before even the State Department and U.S. intelligence agencies what was going on the ground in the various places. So even though he was a critic of the U.N., there was nothing isolationist about him. He was he believed in the United States that would be very much engaged in the world, and particularly on behalf of fighting communism.
And he raised some eyebrows in 94 after the Republicans got control of Congress. He took over the Foreign Relations Committee. There were people who wanted him to go onto the Agriculture Committee or things that may have a more direct impact on North Carolina, but he always had a profound interest in foreign affairs.
Well, that was his first love, some of the things he was most proud of, and he talks about somewhat in his memoirs, are his longtime friendship with former Prime Minister, now Lady Margaret Thatcher. He was an early champion of some people who were unpopular in the United States, with the United States government, because of détente. We didn't want to alienate people like Solzhenitsyn. You know, he was seeing Solzhenitsyn early on at a time when the U.S. government under Kissinger and détente did not want to alienate the Soviet government. He was befriended people like Harry Wu, you know, the dissident in China, and also, I must add, some fairly unsavory characters, too, like Roberto Dobison, who was reportedly tied in with some of the death squads in, I guess, Guatemala, was it? Guatemala. Foreign relations, even back to the days when he was a Raleigh TV commentator, were really his first love.
You know, we're getting into now what I think is part of the Helms legacy. You know, when Helms went to the Senate in 73, his mentors were not Republicans. They were conservative Democrats like Jim Allen from Alabama and Harry Byrd from Virginia. And Senator Byrd was actually there the other night, Rob, still very distinguished in silver hair, but looking a little frail. But Helms was virulently anti-communist from the day he walked into the Senate, and a passion for fiscal responsibility. He routinely voted against all foreign aid bills, routinely voted against the budgets that weren't balanced, always introduced balanced budget amendments. The first guy, I think the first bill he introduced was a flat tax bill. And in those first years, he was on the losing end of a lot of 99-1 votes. And as Rob has pointed out, he really stayed pretty consistent to that initial line that he hewed in the Senate and stayed there throughout 30 years. And I think that's what North Carolinians came to trust about him, is unlike a lot of other politicians, you always knew where you could find Helms. And I think that's his legacy. He fought for things that ended up being mainstream ideas. He was just about 20 years ahead of their popularity.
We're talking about the long political career of Senator Jesse Helms. His new memoir, Here's Where I Stand, was published earlier this month. Just ahead, more of your calls at 877-962-9862 on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Adam Hochberg. Jesse Helms was voted into the U.S. Senate 5 times by North Carolina voters, and during a 30-year career, he took on many controversial issues. In a 1983 interview, he was asked by NPR's Sanford Unger how he'd like to be remembered.
I would like to be remembered as a fellow who did the best he could and who didn't back down when he thought he was right. And if I've done anything, made any contribution, and I don't say that I have, It is that I have introduced into the dialogue some things that may not have been introduced otherwise.
Earlier this month, Jesse Helms released his memoir, Here's Where I Stand, and today we're examining his many stands. With us in the studio are Tom Fetzer, the former mayor of Raleigh, Carrie Haney, a professor of political science at Duke University, and Rob Christensen, a political columnist and reporter at the News and Observer of Raleigh. Joining us at 877-962-9862 is Fred in Raleigh. Welcome to The State of Things, Fred.
Good morning, folks. I wanted to bring up a couple of things about Senator Helms' legacy that I've been mortified about over the years, but I haven't been able to do anything, though I've tried. In the political process, organizations, very important. Senator Helms seemed to empower people who were poor and ignorant, but he also empowered the intelligence of people, and he did it, I think, in a way that preachers do from the pulpit. He had his own Channel 5 pulpit before. He also used unfortunately, the intelligent people, like, and Tom is one of them, use justification saying that Senator Helms talked this way 15 years ago about racism, and that's the way it was. But when they brought him out in 72, they said the same exact thing. He talked about, he was racist in the 50s in his writings, et cetera, et cetera. That same excuse doesn't hold. I'm embarrassed by it, and I think a lot of North Carolinians are, but unfortunately, we seem to be in the 48-52 minority now. The mullahs do the same thing in churches, in their mosques, as the Baptist right wing or whoever the right wing is considered from the pulpits these days. And it's unfortunate. The same thing happened in order to control power in the Middle Ages. They did the same thing. The priest could write nobody else could. Well, nowadays, they use this as their bully pulpit to control things.
Well, Kerry Haney, the Almanac of American Politics, once said that no American politician was more controversial, beloved in some quarters and hated in others, than Jesse Helms. And I think what this caller is saying is maybe that is the 48% or the 47% that he never attracted in the elections.
Yes, I mean, it is an amazing figure in politics because of the polarization of his support. But, you know, Tom made the point, and the caller, Fred, makes the point, that this language that Helms used 15 years ago, it is the same language he used when he was elected in 72 and prior to that as a commentator. And what I found striking in his book, that it never changed. That when you read Jesse Helms' writing in 2005, it reads as though it's Jesse Helms in 1972. And I guess that's part of his principles. He's, you know where I stand, and he stays there. But it's amazing. And one incident in particular from the book that I like to reference, it was when he talked about the Graham-Smith Senate race and that infamous picture now that appeared in that campaign. And it was charged and alleged that Helms was responsible, at least had a part to play in it. And to my knowledge, in this book is the first time that he ever sort of took that on head on and denied it, and even says that he wouldn't even stoop to the level of responding to such allegations. I mean, here's someone called a racist. Had he been called an anti-communist, an atheist, I suspect Senator Helms would have responded. But here on the issue of race and the language that he used, he didn't respond. I found that very odd and striking, and it stood out in the book for me.
Tom, do you have a response to that?
Well, no, I don't. I think that Helms sort of wore the criticism from the left and from the media sort of a badge of honor. And I think, Kerry, part of his modus was not to apologize for it, not to try to defend it, but to just keep on doing what he felt was right and not try to answer all the critics. And I think that he felt some of the characterizations were so unfair that he chose... I guess he felt to respond to him would add credence to them.
Tom, if I might, let me just say, you know, I grew up in North Carolina as a citizen, and I'm thinking about hearing my mother, a 66-year-old who grew up in Mecklenburg and Barrett counties, who suffered the indignities of, you know, discrimination and segregation in the South. And for Senator Helms not to even acknowledge and recognize that, even looking back with hindsight in 2005, seems not to recognize that there may be a different view. That different people may have different opinions about some of those issues. Not to even acknowledge that seems odd and has to be a part of the legacy of Jesse Helms, that he created these divides, widened some divides, and then left them there for others to deal with.
Well, again, I think a lot of people are reacting to the persona of Jesse Helms that they saw on television or read about the newspapers, but I have not been able to find in the last quarter century anybody who interacted with Helms personally who came away feeling that they were treated any less than just an absolute princely behavior. He had an ability to sincerely charm just about everybody he encountered, and so I think we have to judge a man on different levels. Certainly we've acknowledged that that he used issues to political advantage that had racial connotations, but on a personal level, his conduct and his treating of people, I think, is impeccable.
Olin in Chapel Hill, welcome to the State of Things.
Hello.
Hello.
Was that Rob Christensen who just said that politics is about being divisive?
I think that was Tom Fetzer who said that.
That was Tom? Goodness. Well, anyway, what a spectacularly disappointing and irresponsible remark. I'm very concerned to gather how extreme these positions seem to become. We need to have a shift in our culture towards an ethical understanding of human potential. Jesse was the very emblem of a lack of ethical sensibility in politics and of support of the narrowest sorts of social vision. And it's really a sad thing what a triumphant career he had.
Now, Tom, I think what you said was that politics is about creating divisions, and you were talking about campaigns at that point.
Political campaigns, yeah. I mean, that's what they do. They... you try to drive voters to you or drive voters away from your opponent. That's the nature of it. And I think certainly, you know, it used to be that that kind of division was only within the Democratic Party, because if you won the Democratic primary, you won the election. And Rob and I were talking about this on the car on the way over. I mean, some of the most bitterly contested campaigns were Democratic primaries in the first three quarters of the 20th century. And now that the Republican Party is more competitive, it's more of a two-party state, those competitions are taking place between Republicans and Democrats. But politics, political campaigns have been divisive since the late 1700s, and they will continue to be. And to think or hope otherwise is, I think, a disregard for reality.
The thing that you have to remember is that when Helms was coming up in politics, this state was still Democratic, although it was changing rapidly, and Helms was helped changing it rapidly. And so in order to win, for somebody like a Senator Helms to win, Republican, he had to demonize his opponent. He had to portray his opponent as somebody who was doesn't think like you or me, that he's somehow the alien other, and for that reason they would use issues like race or gay issues or other kinds of issues, portraying his Democratic opponent as some sort of extremist or doesn't think like the average North Carolinian, and so that is they felt, Helms and his advisors, I believe, felt it was necessary to go on the attack and to whittle the Democratic opponent down by putting him on the defensive and portraying him as an extremist, and they used these wedge issues to do so.
You know, that's fine in politics, too, and it is about divisions, but it should be divisions over the issues. And even after the campaign where you have a campaign that's hard-fought and there's battles over issues, after the campaign, there's a time for healing and bringing together, and that we never saw from Senator Helms in his career. I object to the notion that it's okay to use any issue in politics because it helps you win. I mean, we have to have some line drawn somewhere. But even if you're going to have hard-fought elections about the issues, I mean, it's incumbent upon politicians to act with a campaign to bring people together. He's the senator of the entire state of North Carolina once he wins.
Kerry, he did exactly that, as I mentioned previously, following the 84 campaign in his acceptance speech, where he realized the campaign had bruised some feelings and allowed for some mischaracterizations to accrue and tried to address that. I do want to mention two things before we run out of time that I think are Helms' lasting political legacies in North Carolina, the first of which was alluded to earlier. I mean, Helms spent about $250,000 getting elected to the Senate in 1972. It was the pre-Watergate federal election laws, and Hugh Chatham and Ed Morris signed a note to the campaign for about $120,000 in the last few days to get to that point. And then the Congressional Club was created quite by accident. Helms had about a $90,000 campaign debt. Ellis bumped into a guy named Richard Vigory who said, I think I can retire that with a couple of mailings. They did. And the next time Helms ran for the Senate, he spent $7 million, and the art of modern campaigning was born in North Carolina, for good or for bad. And secondly, of course, Ronald Reagan would not have been president and would not have changed the world if Helms had not been the first United States senator to endorse him in 76. And his campaign team, through Ellis and Wren, won the North Carolina primary for Reagan and catapulted him into a national star. And I believe that is maybe his most profound contribution to North Carolina and American politics.
Another contribution for people in our profession, Rob. I don't know if Jesse Helms coined the term liberal media, but he certainly was fighting the News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer and the Winston-Salem Journal and all of the newspapers that he perceived as liberal as early as the 50s and 60s. That issue really worked well for him. There was something, we have to admit, there was something that really resonates in the electorate of North Carolina and elsewhere with that line of attack.
Well, 2 points. One is that Jesse Helms really was the early Rush Limbaugh. I mean, he was out there giving these cutting-edge conservative commentaries in a time when before there were all these radio talk shows. Secondly, that North Carolina's newspapers tend to be a little bit center-left in terms of their editorial philosophy, and the state tends to be a little center-right in its political philosophy. So the newspapers, particularly the major newspapers, have always been a little bit unpopular and an inviting target. Although you have to remember, not only did Senator Helms work at the News Observer, but he met his wife there, who was also working for the News Observer. So he actually came out of the old nuisance and disturber.
And that's still a a tactic that politicians are using to this day. And Senator Helms says in the book he was elected five times in North Carolina. He never got the endorsement of the News and Observer, and I don't think any other major paper in the state, which either says something about Senator Helms or probably says more about the News and Observer and the rest of the press.
Well, I could remember many times he once had his folks throw me out of a state Republican convention.
I remember that.
they passed a resolution, whereas News Observer's a suck-egg mule, whereas. And as I was being led out, one of Senator Helms' proteges, a fundamentalist minister, Barry McCarty from Elizabeth City, says, as I was being led out of the convention, people were yelling and screaming, they were saying, "The cancer has been surgically removed."
And that would be you.
That would be me.
John in Chapel Hill, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the State of Things.
My call. I was reading something at one point about Senator Helms, and I just said to some friends later, I wondered what his political ideal for the national government was. Was he in favor of a Christian theocracy? And I'll take my answer off the phone. Thanks.
Tom?
Well, I don't think there's any argument that that Helms' faith, which he alluded to often during his political career, had a profound influence on where he came down, the issues, and the way he conducted himself. And I certainly, he feels like the history of this country was the people who wrote the Declaration, the Constitution, had a profound faith in God, and it's inherent through the document and through the course of the country, and that Helms felt like that when the country drifted away from the faith of the Founding Fathers, it drifted into troubled waters. And he, I think, certainly believed that a reinstitution of that faith or a resurgence or renaissance of that faith was important. And I certainly feel like he would kind of mumble and grumble and dispense out-of-hand arguments about separation of church and state, that the Constitution was specific about not formulating a national religion, but that religious life was a very healthy component of the Republic.
You work with political candidates now. Do you think we will see another like Jesse Helms?
Yeah, I do. I do. And, Rob's been around this long enough. Politics moves in cycles. It goes in circles. And there may be people out there who... Certainly a guy like Santorum in Pennsylvania is Helms in sometimes in the things he says. The governor of Arkansas, Huckabee, I think is his name, is another. So there'll be others to follow.
Let me say, I disagree with that in the sense that Jesse Helms was the last of a dying breed of the old racial conservatives in politics. I think that era is gone. A race is not out of politics by any means. But in the way that Jesse Helms used race, I think that era is gone. I think Republicans are happy that Jesse Helms is gone. It helps the Republican Party be more appealing to racial minorities that they need to attract, remain competitive.
Rob Christensen, quick last word.
The caller said what would be Helms' vision if he ruled the world or whatever, and I think it's 1920s. It was, where life was the Norman Rockwell version of life when whites were still in control.
The gold standard.
Gold standard, before the New Deal and big government.
And on that note, we will have to end our look back at Jesse Helms' legacy of North Carolina. I'd like to thank our callers and thank our panel for being with us today. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Adam Hochberg, and we will leave today with some sounds from Senator Helms' 1990 campaign against Harvey Gantt as the senator thanked supporters and tussled with the media at the polls on Election Day.
Let the Senator speak.
I don't believe it's possible to have a press conference as unruly as you fellows are. I mean, you're falling over them, pushing me around, pushing my family around. When is enough enough with you? Huh? You ask stupid questions to start with. Now, let me speak to my other folks. The real folks. Thank you for coming out. Do you think we ought to teach the Gantt people a little manners?
Yeah.
Everywhere we've gone, there they are. Little insults here, little insults there. I hope our folks haven't done that to him.
We haven't.
Good.
That's not classic.
Does Gantt run an unfair campaign?
I'm not. Please leave me alone. I'm talking to my folks, and I'd like to have a little audience with them.
We love you, Jesse. Go ahead, speak, Senator.